you know, the first thing we're doing is selling a business. So no joke, we were working 100 to 120 hours a week for like 4 months straight to get the business sold. Because, you know, you have a day job. You're not telling everybody that there's this potential that you sell the business. And so you're still running 60, 70 hours a week just running the business. And then you got to go sell the business at the same time.
I'm Matt Tate, founder of Decimal and fellow entrepreneur. Yes, I'm one of the crazy ones. I've chosen time and time again to hustle my way through that first million. Now, I'm scaling to the next 50. So I know firsthand what the messy middle is really like. And I know that entrepreneurs and leaders like us need a destination for empowerment, community, and encouragement. This is our place. This is After the First Million. Mark Caswell, former CEO at Resultan, joins me to share his unexpected path from engineer to business leader. Under his leadership, Resultan acquired 4 companies, more than doubled its revenue, and grew its workforce from 60 employees to almost 500 nationwide. In our conversation, Mark shares his journey of the messy middle, of running a business marked by a mixture of authenticity and self-discovery. Mark, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Matt. It's good to be here. Always fun to talk to you.
I joke with people all the time that if you want to start a business, do end up starting a business or running a company, you're definitely crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So when did you know that you were one of the crazy ones?
It happened to me on accident, believe it or not. Sort of. So
what do you mean?
Well, so I was a farm kid back in the day. I was a farm kid. My dad was a teacher. My mom stayed at home. There was 57 kids in my class. So none of us really knew what the actual world was all about. And my dad happened to be a physics teacher. There were 13 of us in physics, and he told us to go be engineers. And so something like 11 of us went to be engineers. And so that's what I wanted to do. I like technical things. And so I went to Rose Holman. So that was in Michigan. I came to Rose Holman. That's how I ended up in Indiana and did the engineering thing. I was a mechanical engineer, wanted to go into deep space rocketry just to make sure everyone knew what a giant nerd I was. So I ended up out at Stanford where they had a great program for that. And turned out I didn't want to get my PhD because I didn't end up liking research. So I got my master's and I thought, oh, I'll go into the working world. Rolls-Royce aerospace, not cars. So think jet engines. Was at Rolls-Royce for a little over 10 years. And it was great. I actually loved it. First 5 years were super technical. Then I got into the business side on accident. That was maybe the first step towards the end of your question. And I remember doing the technical thing. I thought, oh, I'll do this for 35 years. I'll become what they call the Rolls-Royce fellow. So you're the best in the world at some esoteric technical subject. And I loved that. But then I had a mentor tap me on the shoulder to lead a small team. And then a small team became a bigger team. And it turned out I liked the business side just as much as, if not more, than the technical side. I'm a bit of a people pleaser, maybe a lot of a people pleaser. And so I like it when people win and I like people. And when you got over to the business side, you got to create things where everybody can win. The client can win, the employees can win, the user of the products can win. It's very complicated. The technical stuff is complicated and intellectually challenging, but the human stuff is even more so. And the human stuff changes all the time. The laws of physics don't change. They are the same as they've always been. But the human stuff changes all the time. So you'll have a solution today on how to approach something, and that's different next week, and it's definitely different 2 years from now. And so I think I found that challenge fun. It was also just a bunch of stuff I'd never been exposed to. I didn't have any sort of business training, and so that was interesting. That was good. I loved it. I was in their kind of leadership program, and they were very good to me. But I got to this point where I think Rolls-Royce, 50,000 person global business, you know, I'm all over the world. It's big and you get to see cool things, but you also never see everything. Mm-hmm. You're always a part of this huge thing. And I knew if I really wanted to run a piece of that business, I needed to see it all. And so I thought, I'll go leave for a couple years, go to a small company, come back. I need to go do a time in a small company and then that'll help me in the big company thing. Now that was true. I would have been better, but I ended up at now Resultan. It was 18 people. This super entrepreneurial guy named Charlie Brandt, who had never worked with anyone like him before. And I thought, well, this is perfect. I'll get to learn from him. I will get to go consult with all these companies. That'll be great. That'll scratch this itch that I've got. And it was true. It was great. And it was so great that I decided to stay. And we just kept growing. I mean, we grew at something like 40% per year on average. And I was COO for a hot second. And then I'm not sure if I got moved out of that or fired out of that, but I wasn't COO for a while. I didn't have a title for 2 years. I jumped around to different spots. And the business just kind of kept growing and growing. And, you know, it's the entrepreneurial phase of the journey. You just do whatever you need to do. And then one day, the founder, Charlie, tapped me on the shoulder. He says, "Hey, we're selling the business. I would like you to be CEO. I'm not going to go with the business. So you need to be the one to sell it. Good luck." And I thought, okay, cool. I never, you know, CEO was not really on my horizon. I love leading teams, of course. And I was as ambitious as everyone. And I think the right way. But it wasn't like, yeah, you know, I was trying to get to that spot. It just sort of happened to me.
So I find that a lot of engineers that I know or people with engineering backgrounds are tinkers. And they almost like to take things apart as much as build them and put them together and just understanding the whole.
Yep.
Do you feel like moving over to what was KSM, now Resultant, gave you the organizational ability to tinker more than Rolls-Royce, to really understand the reasons and why and all the pieces that go into running a company?
That is a really good way to put it. I've never thought of that before. I think you're absolutely right. So I agree with what you just said. I think engineers are tinkerers. The way I've always phrased that is I never truly internalize something until I know the why. Mm-hmm. To know the why, you really got to break it apart and look inside. But no, I hadn't thought of that for business. I think that's right. I think that's why I loved it. I mean, you saw everything, everything.
I want to talk about when you first became CEO. But for those years when you were kind of wandering in the wild and had no title, was that hard? Was that fun? Were you able to just do a lot of different things? What about that prepared you to be the guy that got tapped on the shoulder?
It was hard. It was fun. It was both of those things. I guess I would have two answers to your question. What prepared me? I think breadth and grit are the two words that come to mind. So from a breadth perspective, in a small company, there's no legal department. You get a contract and you stare at it, and you probably don't have the money to go hire a lawyer, and there is no law department. And so you're just like, well, I don't know, like, let's read it and try to be as smart as we can. But you just had to figure it out because there was no one else. So you either did nothing or you figured it out. And so you got into lots of little tiny nooks and crannies of the business that you'd never get into if it wasn't small and crazy and in that entrepreneurial zone, which again goes back to your point on figuring things out and tinkering a little bit. But the other thing was grit. It was hard. It was hard in a way that was different from how it was hard later. I think business is always hard. That's why they pay you. I guess I came out of the corporate world and there was like a career path ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And I knew if I did this for 2 years, I'd get 4% raises instead of 3% raises, but then I'd get this promotion to this thing. And it was like, just like the path was very clear. There were perturbations off that path and everything. But in a small business, there's no path. Every day you try to do the best you can with what's in front of you. I wasn't the leader of the business at that point. That was Charlie. And so Charlie would try to make the best decisions that he could. And sometimes I liked those decisions and sometimes I didn't, right? I mentioned I was COO for 9 months. Now, I should have known. I think I was our 8th COO in like 6 years. So this was not like a high probability that I would be in that role very long. He moved me out of that role after 9 months. And I was mad. I was really mad because it was like, well, I've got an executive title now. Like, I've arrived. And
the C-suite.
That's right. And I was super mad when he moved me out of it. And it was petulant and I was being nearsighted instead of farsighted. And he was absolutely right to move me out of it. But it took me a while though to like figure that out.
Why didn't you leave? Because a lot of people, and I think more and more today, they leave.
Well, I mentioned to you that I wanted to stay for 2 years. That was kind of this arbitrary line I had in my head. Near the end of that 2 years, I realized 2 years isn't long enough to learn from your own mistakes. At Rolls-Royce, actually, they were moving me pretty quickly. In certain cases, every 6 months, I'd move to a new job. Who knows if I was actually any good at it? Because by the time all your mistakes come home to roost, somebody else has the job and it's not your problem anymore, right? So when I got to that 2-year mark, I remember thinking, I haven't been here long enough to know if the things I've done were really good. I need to stay here long enough to deal with my own mistakes. The first time I thought, I want to go do the next thing because I want to learn is when I came to Resultant. The first time I thought, I want to do things to learn that are hard and potentially bad was probably that moment. So when I moved out of that role, I mean, I remember thinking about it, like, of course, like maybe I should go somewhere else if you move me out. And it actually didn't take me that long to figure out, like, no, there's so much more to learn here. Like, suck it up, Caswell. And maybe he sees something that you don't see. Maybe there's another opportunity. You can't just throw in the towel because you had one bad day, right? Figure out what you need to learn and keep moving forward.
What you've talked about so far, that moment and that kind of transparency and honesty with yourself feels like a big turning point for you. And now that you've done this all the way through multiple exits, almost the first executive thought, that felt like a turning point for you in your thinking like a CEO.
Maybe.
When you decide you want to learn from your mistakes and have that full thing come full circle, when you have our job, there's no running away.
Yeah.
There's nobody else to point to. And so you get used to accountability.
Yeah.
But you were seeking it.
So I mentioned my father was a school teacher. So when I was growing up, that was my experience of his job. Actually, I had four jobs. He refed basketball. He coached. He was a school teacher. He also did township supervisor and some things like that. Needless to say, the guy works pretty hard. I had a good example. After I left the House, he ran for government in Michigan for the legislature. So he won 3 terms as a House rep, and there were 2 counties together. And then he ran for Senate and won a term for Senate. Could have got a second term, but he decided I'd rather watch the grandkids play sports. So he didn't run again. But I remember when he first got elected to Senate, he calls me and he tells me, hey, I won. And it was some crazy, like he got like 80% of the vote or something. It was crazy, right? He made this comment to me. He says, you know, it's really humbling. And I did not say this out loud, but inside my head, I'm like, Dad, that is the biggest bunch of bull I've ever heard. How could that possibly be humbling? Everyone voted that they like you best of all the other choices, right? That's like the opposite of humbling.
Popularity contest, you crushed it.
You crushed it. Yeah. But, you know, I didn't say anything at the time, but I remembered that moment. It stuck into my head. Well, when I got into the CEO role, I'm not kidding you, it was like day 2 or 3, that story popped back into my head and suddenly it made sense because I was president before that, but I still had Charlie over the top looking out for me. I still had somebody I could point at if I needed to. And once I got into that seat, there wasn't anybody else to point at. And all of a sudden you're like, crap, this is humbling. And the reason it's humbling is because you realize you're not enough. You're just not. There is no one human being that can do it all. You need amazing people around you. You're going to have failures. You're going to have gaps. You're going to learn. And that is really humbling. It should be humbling. Now, if you're a complete narcissist, I think CEO is the best job in the world because you just make everything everybody else's fault. But if you're not a narcissist, it's really humbling because you're not enough and you never will be.
I want to ask you about when you first took over the CEO role, but I want to fast forward really quickly. So you joined Resultant when there were 18 people.
Yep.
How many years later did you finally leave Resultant and how large was it?
Well, leaving an active role in the business, it was 10 years. So I'm still on the board of Resultant and I still talk to folks and do strategy and help where I can. But leaving an active kind of day-to-day role, it was 10 years and we're just a little shy of 500 folks when I left.
So you grew just a little bit.
A little bit. Maybe 3/4 of that growth was inorganic. And then we did a little bit of acquisition as well. We bought 4 companies along the way.
My point in bringing that up is you have had quite a bit of success over that 10-year period of growing a company, of building a business, building a culture through a lot of different things. When you started as CEO, you started with 2 big problems. 1, you're a CEO, and that's a problem for all of us. 2, you were going through an acquisition.
Yeah, true. Yep.
Which is also not an easy thing to do. Talk about how you balanced that. You get appointed to the job. You are now the boss. It's like 5 minutes of the greatest thing ever. At what point did you realize, oh shit, this is harder than I thought it was?
Well, first of all, it was not 5 minutes of the greatest thing ever. My initial reaction was anger, which is weird because I got told we were selling the business at the same time I got told I was going to be CEO. I didn't have it like on a checklist that CEO was a goal. I was very happy. Like, let's not feel bad for the CEOs. This was great. It's going to be great for my family. But I was mad. I had no idea what it meant to sell a company. And all the stories I heard were disasters where somebody had bought somebody and dismantled the company. Or, you know, I had this idea in my head of like what private equity was and some sharks in tuxedos trying to take everybody money and bleed them dry, right? And so my initial was like, I'll be damned if you're going to screw this thing up that we're building because it's amazing. Now, over the course of a couple of weeks, I realized this is actually how we go build the thing that we go build. And we have a lot of say in who buys us and that they're the type of people that would like what we're doing and be aligned to our culture and all those things. So I quickly kind of calmed down. But my initial reaction was anger because I thought it was going to break a thing that I loved. Now, as far as it getting hard, I don't know that there was a moment where I realized it was hard. I think it was just immediately hard. You know, the first thing we're doing is selling a business. So no joke, we were working 100 to 120 hours a week for like 4 months straight to get the business sold. Because, you know, you have a day job. You're not telling everybody that there's this potential that you sell the business. And so you're still running 60, 70 hours a week just running the business. And then you got to go sell the business at the same time, which is a bunch of other work. Now, don't mistake that for negativity, though. It was fun. It was really fun. It was the best MBA you can ever get.
Because you were learning so much day to day, minute by minute?
Yeah. Like you ever try to, you know, explain your business to someone who's thinking of buying it? I mean, that is a complex, nuanced thing. And you got people from strategic buyers, you've got private equity buyers of different flavors, and they all want to hear the story a slightly different way and ask new questions. And you just trial by fire, you get a lot of knowledge very, very quickly on what it takes to build a great business and talk about it.
You kind of hit on two things that I found in talking to successful CEOs, and I want to dive into both. One, I think everybody has sort of a I'll be damned mentality at times. You know?
Yes. We are not known for our passivity.
No. And I think that's part of being in the job is being able to say, we're going forward. The other thing that you mentioned is being excited to learn. That's one of the things that kind of I see energizes people. So as you went through that process as a new CEO, so you basically have two jobs that you're drinking from a fire hose. How did you balance that while maintaining what, from the outside looking in, always seemed like a really good culture?
Fundamentally, at the core of who I am as a person, I just care deeply about other human beings. And if I'm going to create something in the world, it ought to be worth creating because it benefits other people. Money is stupid. Everybody that I've known that starts a business solely with the purpose of making money, like that doesn't tend to go very well. But people who are like, I want to solve this problem in the world, or I want to build this thing because it's good for these reasons, that tends to go better. I guess there's like a fundamental belief in what it means to show up and build something great, and it's build something great for people. I think that's what it's all about. So having said that, I think I was just kind of constantly on my mind as we went through this, like what is best for everyone? How do we communicate? How do we inspire people? How do we let them feel the feeling? I remember when we announced it to the company, I stood in front of, gosh, I think it was 80 some people at that point. And I said, hey, whatever you're feeling right now is right. There's no right way to feel about this announcement. Some of you are mad. Some of you are sad. Some of you are excited. Some of you have been through a horrible experience before and are scared. Some of you have been through a good experience like this and are joyful. But whatever you're feeling right now, there's no wrong feeling. I was mad. I told them the story I told you a few minutes ago. Like I was mad when I found this out. And then I came to this place. So my expectation is, as you learn about this, like I learned about this, you'll come to the same conclusion I did. I'm not going to get up here and do some sort of song and dance to say you should all be happy by the time you leave this room. That's just not reality. And so I think guiding people through that process and letting them feel the feels, as we say about my 10-year-old, I think that was helpful because it let people authentically get to the place that they needed to get to their way, not some forced way.
It's amazing how much you learn building a company is applicable to raising kids and how much about kids is applicable to building a company.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we're all just people, right?
So you obviously went through your first acquisition and that happened. And so you basically started your first job as CEO in chaos, more chaos than is normal for a CEO building a company. Then you have to go to the next stage. You have to get into rebuilding company, the monotony of just what is normal growth within, obviously, private equity, so faster than most. How did you adapt from the chaos of the 100, 120 hour weeks and two jobs to now I'm the CEO of a company that I have to build?
It was probably 8 weeks after the transaction. So we sold the business at the end of March in 2019. So this would have put kind of end of May, call it. And one of my friends in the business, she came to me after some meeting and she just kind of looked at me. She was like, "Hey, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'm totally fine. Why?" She goes, "I don't think you're okay." And luckily I had a friend to say this to me. But what had happened is I had been up at this stress level. And by the way, it wasn't a bad stress level. I told you it was fun. Like there were hard parts for sure. There always are, right? But mostly it was fun. It was engaging. I was getting to scratch that curiosity itch and all that kind of stuff. But at the other side, I felt like I'd come down in stress, but I'd only come down a little bit, which felt better, but it wasn't down to like a normal, sustainable, apparently pleasant to be around level. And luckily I had a friend that was like, "Hey, maybe you ought to get yourself together, man." And after that, I had to take like 6 weeks to methodically walk myself down. Like it was a process to walk myself down, to get myself down. And I'm like a fairly hyper person on average. So just to get down to like normal hyper mark. That was really hard. And this isn't just a CEO thing. I think this is an everybody in all aspects of life thing. Like when you go through hard stuff and you come out the other side, you got to like take care of yourself. I think we all learned in high school, if you go run a race, you got to stretch afterwards. Otherwise, you're going to cramp up and be miserable for a week. I think it's the same in life. Like you go through hard things, you go through stressful periods at work, and you got to, you know, like find a way to walk yourself back down afterwards to get to a sustainable level. That was tough. That was really tough. I would say I lucked out on the running the business side because I had a phenomenal team. We've always punched above our weight class on the talent we're able to bring to the organization. And much of what I was doing in the sale of the business, which was describing our future, talking about the business and the pieces of it, was kind of also my job on the other side. Granted, in a different context, but I feel like we had such amazing people that all I really had to do was point at the mountaintop and be like, "That mountaintop over there, it's worth taking for all these reasons. Let's go, y'all." I'm also a terrible manager, so nobody really wanted me to do that.
I always joke that I'm good at getting people to jump off a bridge. I just can't get them to line up to do it. And it sounds like it might be a similar problem. So one thing that you kind of brought up that I think is important, and you and I both grew up 80s, 90s was a lot of our formative years, and understanding balance, mental health, how to take care of ourselves, I wouldn't say was a big part of my growing up or a lot of people of our generations growing up.
Nope.
Was this the moment that you started getting a good understanding of that? Or when did you start understanding that the best you involved occasionally being selfish for you?
Yes, actually, that was the same time. And what's interesting is I had been told that before. Like as a leader, you have to take care of yourself so that you can take care of your team. I'd nodded my head when somebody told me that. And I think I actually just thought it was BS. Because, you know, for a lot of us, the first 15, 20 years of our career, we just achieve. You just get stuff done. And if you tend to get it done faster and better than everybody else, like that's what you're rewarded for. But at a certain point, that achievement thing, it becomes impossible to achieve all the things anymore. And in fact, you would argue as a CEO, that's not really your job. Your job is to create an organization that achieves things, not personally achieve things. And I've seen a lot of us coming out of the land of entrepreneurial get stuck at that place where we think it's still our job to achieve, or things start going bad. And so you go back to what used to work, which is you personally doing everything, which, by the way, works less and less the more into that journey you get. But yeah, that moment made it real for me. The organization needs me to show up well. Nobody wants to work for a burned out jerk. You've heard that phrase.
Yeah.
If I don't show up well, then the organization's going to suffer. The mission is going to suffer. The clients are going to suffer. And therefore, it's actually on my job description. One of the things I almost say to everyone is like, listen, the first bullet point on your job description is manage yourself. Like, you have to take care of yourself. You have to manage your life. Because if you get too far off in one direction, like, it's going to go bad for everybody. I mean, let alone you. It's going to go bad for everybody around you.
One of the other things that I think that I've learned, and I'd be interested in your take on this, is that taking care of yourself is like go-to-market fit. It's a moving target. And once you've found it, you're going to lose it again.
Mm-hmm.
How did that kind of play itself out throughout your journey?
Well, I had an executive coach for a while, Jennifer Manning, who is amazing and was tremendously helpful to me in figuring that out for myself. And we would just talk about it. So I think that is probably one piece of advice I would have, is like, get out of your own head and get help from other people in figuring that stuff out. The times in my life where I've gotten stuck in my own head with my problems, that never really goes well. In fact, sometimes it goes pretty bad. You got to get people around you to help you. So talk about this stuff. I got a network, Matt, you being one, a network of other leaders that I would talk to, and we just talk about this stuff. You're absolutely right. The target moves. Best example in our life is we have three kids. Sam is 15, Kate is 13, Ella is 10. And so like, how we take care of our family in that period of life is way different than when they were babies, is way different from when we didn't have kids at all, will be way different from when they're in college and we're empty nesters.
So let's go back to, you have sold the company to the first private equity firm. And normally, your first private equity firm has a hold period of X number of years. You guys blew that out of the water and grew like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I talk to people about as our company has grown, as they grow their company, your job as a CEO changes. And I know you and I have talked about in the past. Talk about how, as that job changed, that affected you, and when did you start to realize it? Talk about that growth and what it meant for you.
In a high growth business, the leader you have to be now is different from the leader you have to be 6 months from now. Unfortunately, to learn how to be the leader you need to be 6 months from now, you need at least a year. You're just never caught up, ever. And you do the best you can. You bring other people with you. It's part of why a great culture is important, because it gives everybody a little bit of a leeway as well. So we closed with Renovus, who was a great first partner for us. I say they just unleashed us. Like, we just started running. And I think we sold the business 21 months later. It went well for them. We grew the business approximately 4X over that time. Little shy of 4X over that time. And it was a blast. And we had a lot of momentum. I mean, we were just doing meaningful work in the world. So a lot of opportunity came our way, and we didn't really have to create a lot of structure and process and discipline to do that 21 months of growth. And if you don't have to, you tend not to. And so we just didn't create a lot of that structure. Well, then we sold the business again, which was hard and fun again, to InvestCorp, also a great partner. By the way, like, I had this idea that private equity people were jerks. None of them I've worked with are jerks. I'm sure there are jerks. There are jerks in every industry out there, but surprisingly great, smart people, at least per what I'd been told. So we had a second great partner in InvestCorp. Renovus also continued to invest in us. But right after we closed with that, what we realized is, like, this next phase of scale, it's going to require a lot more diligence. It's going to require a lot more structure, a lot more focus. It felt like in the course of like 3 months, we just like became a different business. All of a sudden we were big. Now, not as big as Rolls-Royce was, but for a smaller company, we were big, right? We were like corporate-y. And the type of leader I had to be in that was like totally different. Like, of course, the inspiration stuff, the culture stuff still 100% applies. But like, my day-to-day got a lot different. Started to shift towards board management, first of all, became more and more important. I was leading and managing executives, and it was the executives that were doing a lot of what I used to do inside the business, even from a strategic perspective. So more of my day-to-day became management. And then the pieces inside the business that were important to build were the structural components. You know, we needed a phenomenal finance team. We needed a phenomenal FP&A team. We had to have these systems in place. We were pretty god-awful at forecasting our business. And anyway, we're just like, right. I don't know. It seems to always work out. Like, it'll be fine, right?
And you did start in an accounting firm.
We did start in
There's
an accounting firm.
There's irony baked in that whole statement.
Yes. We did not learn that lesson from them. But that became a lot of the job. And for me, that was really hard because I wasn't really built that way. Mm. I was like the anti-process guy at Rolls-Royce. In fact, I almost got fired a couple of times because of it. I always valued it. I knew it was important, but to suddenly have to be the one that's driving it was maybe one of the biggest changes for me.
So the company's grown quite a bit. You're there 10 years. At what point did you start thinking, I'm not finding as much joy? Because one of the things I do hear from you, and I've heard from you in all of our conversations, is you do derive a lot of joy from what you do and from being around people.
Mm-hmm.
But part of, I'm guessing, your decision to retire for 5 minutes was that you started finding less and less joy in the job that was changing. Or was it tired? What kind of started to change to the point where you said, I don't want to go from 500 to 1,000.
I don't know that I would have or would now use the word less joy, although I think I know what you mean, and maybe that would be fine to use. But here's what happened for me. So again, we acquired a business, which I've always found to be really fun. So in this case, we acquired a business out of Dallas called Technion. Great business, like just phenomenal human beings. And it was exciting. And it was one of those deals where like literally everyone wins. We are truly better together. Exciting. All those things. So I came out of that and I did the thing that I mentioned earlier where I intentionally walked myself down in stress and even coached them through doing the same because they were going to experience the same thing that I experienced.
Right.
And I got to the end of that walk down and it didn't really work. And it was the first time it hadn't. We'd sold the business twice. We'd acquired 3 businesses before this one. This wasn't the first time it didn't really work. And so I just kind of sat in that for a couple months. And it was like something was just off. And my wife noticed it and said something to me. And so you remember that network of peers that I talked about? Right? So I started talking to everybody about it, like, you know, what could be wrong? And kind of generally, people kept pointing back to like, man, you guys have grown a lot. Like you're a different business than you were a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So I thought, okay, so I called up one of my board members. This is probably career limiting behavior, but I called up one of them, Nikki, and I was like, hey, Nikki, I am realizing I have no idea what the next 10 years of the business looks like. And I think that's causing me a ton of stress because I've always been able to chart where we're going. I've never worked in a business of that size. I've never worked for anyone that's worked for a business of that size. And I'm noticing a pattern as I talk here, you know, much like I thought all the PE people were jerks. The people that I sort of know that have scaled a business over that size, I think are all jerks, and I'm not interested in doing it if I have to be a jerk, right? Yeah. Which I now know is untrue, but whatever. Petulant Mark said those words. So he said, okay, he's like, you got to talk to my boy Higgy. So it was a guy, Joe Higgins. Joe had run 20 years of private equity backed companies. Awesome, exuberant, optimistic, but also real gritty guy. So I have one conversation with Joe and it's like, okay, this is a guy that's seen it. And one conversation turns to two, turns to three, turns to me hiring him as a new executive coach and eventually him actually joining the company on the board, which I lobbied for. And he was phenomenal. And Joe helped me understand what the next phase of the company looked like. And it was great. And it also wasn't me. The things that the CEO was going to have to do successfully to guide the company to and through that next phase were different than what I'd kind of how I was built, right? I mentioned some of the process and structural stuff and all that. And it was that, it was a few other things as well. And so yes, there was like a me component to it. Like, what do I want to do? How do I want to be fulfilled and joyful and all that kind of stuff? There was a little bit of that, but I would say there was more of, if I'm a responsible leader, how could I possibly have built a thing over the last decade and not find the best way for it to go through the next decade, even if that best way isn't with me at the helm? Like, it's not about me. It's about this organization achieving what we're trying to achieve together. Right. And so I went back to the board and I said, hey, here's what I'm feeling. I said, I'm not running out the door, but I have a sense that there's a better leader for the next phase of the business than me. And I think we owe it to ourselves to go look. And if we find him, great. Let's hire him or her. If we don't find him, that's okay. That's not an emergency. We'll keep going. And so we went out and we did a search. And for about 6 months, we didn't find him. It was kind of underwhelming, actually. Some conversations were great, but some conversations were not great. And I'd kind of thought like, okay, maybe this isn't going to happen. Like, and we were keeping going and the business was running well. And we just had, I think we set a record quarter on track for a record year. And then we ran across Greg Layock, who is now our CEO. This is the person. He's been through it before. For the last 12 years, had been an executive at West Monroe that we had always looked up to as a phenomenal organization. They went from $50 million in revenue to many hundreds of millions in revenue while he was there. Like, he saw this whole journey and he was aligned culturally. Like, we just liked him as a human being, smart, like all the things, right? And so we're like, okay, well, let's see if Greg will come. And he did. And we transitioned over the course of about 6 months, and it was a phenomenal decision. Great for the organization, great for Greg. I'm happy. So I'm really glad we had that extended moment.
So going back, when you really looked yourself in the mirror and you said, I'm not the guy for the next 10 years, did you find that to be a hard thing to do? Was it liberating when you finally made the decision? Combination of both? That's a pretty vulnerable and transparent moment with yourself.
Probably both. I mean, it's hard to admit your own limits.
Yeah.
That is always hard to find and admit a new limit. I think that part was tough. And, you know, there's some like identity stuff that comes up. And I think I was lucky that I hadn't tied my identity too closely to being the CEO. It's like, that's who I am. It was hard. I mean, when I announced it to the organization, I was like right on the edge of tears the entire 20 minutes I was talking to them. I think I crept over the edge like one time because I'd love that place. I love these people and what we'd done. It was meaningful. But I also knew it was right. That was the part that was liberating. Regardless of what it meant for me, it was the right decision. I've tried to always be about, like, let's make the right decision regardless of what it means for me individually or us collectively.
I think that's pretty cool. Yeah. So now, like your dad, who, as you said, admittedly worked four jobs, did four things, five things, 10 things at a time. It keeps kind of, it's crazy. You step down as CEO. You're still on the board.
Yep.
You're also now doing some consulting. You obviously did not take retirement very long or well.
I'm still engaged with Resultant. I'm trying to do what I can to help the organization still be as amazing as it is. I'm teaching at Butler, which is super fun. I'm teaching Entrepreneurial Accelerator, which is kind of the lean startup model. And I'm doing some executive coaching, which I mentioned. And then what I've kind of figured out is I'm actually not that great of an executive coach. Because as soon as I start trying to coach, I just end up consulting. And so a bunch of friends and friends of friends, I'm just helping them solve problems. I guess you might call it management consulting. I don't know. Just fun figuring stuff out with folks.
Well, I think that's really cool. And I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Yeah. Fun to chat. Thanks for thinking of me.
Before we wrap, one of the things I'd love an answer from you for is, what's one piece of advice if you could give yourself when you were first starting, you first got that CEO job that you know now, what would you tell that person?
You have longer than you think. I think I had given this advice to early career people before. In fact, that my class at Butler, I just talked to them. I said, okay, how old is everybody here? You know, they're like 21 years old. I said, okay, at what point in your life, do you feel like you became kind of an independent person making some of your own decisions? And everybody kind of generally says middle school-ish, right? So I said, okay, call it age 11. So 10 years. I said, what age is everybody going to retire? Everybody's kind of like 65, 67, something like that. I said, okay, do the math. How long are you in the workplace? 45 years. The 10 years since you started being responsible for yourself, does that seem like a long time? Like, yeah, that seems like a long time. Well, guess what? Your career is 4.5 times as long as that. Right. I think all of us do that, though. I think we get into roles or companies or situations, and it just feels like everything is so urgent that it all has to happen now. It all has to happen at once. If everything doesn't go perfect, we're off track. That's not actually true. You have more time than you think. Now, if you sign up for the world of private equity, do you have to deliver annual results that are better than the market delivers? Yes, you do. But even then, you don't have to do it all at once. You can calm down a little bit. You can take some of the pressure off yourself to be perfect. You'll find more contentedness in your journey, I think, if you can embrace that. At least I would have had I told myself that.
Well, I think that's great advice. Thanks so much for listening. After the First Million is presented by Decimal. To listen to more episodes and find tips to help make running a business easier, visit decimal.com/AFM. Want to join the conversation? Reach out to me on LinkedIn and let's explore the messy middle.